Welcome to Observations, a program that's devoted to observing Yahweh's testimony so that we might understand who God is, what He is offering, and what He is expecting of us should we wish to participate in His covenant. In our last program, actually a combination of programs, one here on Observations, the other on our Friday evening Shabbat program on Blog Talk Radio, Yada Yah Radio, we have been examining what God had to say about religion and the fact that God is overtly anti-religious. And the discussion really began with a very in-depth analysis of the third verse of the seventh chapter of First Samuel. And in that chapter, or in that particular verse, there were two specific villains. The first villain was Ashtart. And Ashtart is a religious villain. And Ashtart, as we had drilled down on it over the programs, both on Yada Yah Radio and on Observations, is the basis of, and the kind of the central theme, if you will, that transcended her creation in the Babylonian religion as Ashtart, Ishtar, the Mother of God, the Queen of Heaven, the basis of and the name for the Christian holiday of Easter, and then 9 months later in the Nativity on the winter solstice, what Christians call Christmas, that she is the virgin and child that Christians are so fixated on with their Christmas celebrations and in their art. And so she is a representative of all religion, but specifically Roman Catholicism and Christianity. And the second villain was the Philistine, which is, as we drill down on it, there are foreigners who invade and attempt to occupy that which doesn't belong to them. And they represent militaristic governments. And so as we were trying to glean as much as we could from Yahweh's testimony on these two villains, because the promise in Samuel 7:3, 1 Samuel 7:3, is if you will completely distance yourself from the influence of Ashtart, which would be religion, Christianity specifically, who is represents the whore of Babylon, if you will separate yourself from religion, God will save you from militaristic governments, the Philistine. So we were trying to find out as much as we could from those particular villains. And one of the things we found out is that in Judges, which is in the Hebrew, that would be Shaphat, which is to decide by exercising judgment. We turned to 2:1 and we reviewed a statement from Yahweh regarding religion. And this is how it reads, and then we're going to have Kirk and Scott comment on this statement. It says, and then the messenger, the Malach, this would be the heavenly envoy, the spiritual representative of Yahweh, ascended from Gilgal. We'll talk about what Gilgal represents in a moment, to Boikim. And he said, I chose to continuously lift you up, because you wanted me to take you away from being besieged in the black land. And so I brought you into the land, which relationally I promised to your fathers. And I explained I would never break, I would never split into two, I would never violate, make ineffectual, nor nullify my covenant with you. Ever, throughout the whole of time. We did not turn to this particular passage for the insights we have just received. We will actually confront Ashtart in a moment. But oh my goodness, what a treasure!
It was. It was. It moved me to the point that, and I understood every word. I mean, I translated it and myself, so I didn't miss anything that's critical. But when you really start examining the words and everything, and then I put it in the context of if I was talking to some of my Christian friends,
mm-hmm.
it has just got Paul all over it.
Particularly the way that it ends,
right?
Which is, I will never, under any circumstances, split my covenant into two. I will never violate or make ineffectual my covenant. I will never nullify it. And Pauline Christianity is based on Paul's letters.
Yes.
And Paul's first letter, which was the letter to the Galatians, the Galatians, about the fourth chapter, thereabouts, Paul says that the covenant that was codified on Mount Sinai, which would be the covenant that's found in the Torah, that it was with Hagar, and that it enslaves. Now, when you read the Torah, of course, Hagar was banished.
Mm-hmm.
And her son, Ishmael,
right,
was, and it's, Ishmael is from Ish, individual, Ma, which means what or whose or why, or it means to question. So question this individual's God, because El is God. So Ishmael would mean question this individual's God. So Ishmael was expressly excluded from the covenant. So while Hagar was a slave, she was and her son were banished from the covenant, which means that Paul overtly lied when he wrote that the covenant memorialized in the Torah was with Hagar and thus enslaves. And so then Paul went on after lying, after establishing a false premise, he went on to write, therefore there's a new covenant that is based on faith. And God is saying right here, no, not never, not ever, throughout the whole of time will I create a second or additional covenant. And so Pauline Christianity, with its New Testament, is torn asunder. It's absolutely ripped to shreds, spit out and stamped into the ground, dead on arrival, before it was even born.
Mm-hmm. And when you read this, and I hope Scott doesn't mind if I go first.
Go ahead.
But, is that all right? So I started thinking about all the things that preachers tell you and have over the years, and they tell you the Torah or the Old Testament, as they would call it, is God's word. They'll tell you he's consistent.
Oh, yes.
They'll tell you his promises to rescue his children and return them together to him, and that was the goal.
Yeah, they'll say his word is forever.
His word is forever.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell you that he's not a man to lie.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell you he can make anything that he says come about. Mm-hmm. And his plan is the family covenant. They probably don't talk about that as much, but they did when I was growing up.
Yeah, they don't much anymore.
No, not much.
The covenant is really discouraged.
They talk a lot about Abraham, and they certainly talk about, and so we know what he said to Abraham. They just conveniently say that only counts to him, as if there's two different deals going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Then they talk about it was dictated to Moshe.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we extrapolate from that now, we know, if you've read anything, you know that it's been endorsed by, what he said was endorsed by every prophet of old and every disciple of Yahushua, apparently known as Jesus, of course, keeping in mind that Yahushua never quoted anything but the Torah.
Yeah, Torah and prophets. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so then under any circumstance, that how can that be another plan? I mean, what would make Yah's plan no longer valid?
Oh, it's the most in terms of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It is it really is as stupid could possibly be. In fact, let me just kind of give you a summation of what Pauline doctrine requires. This is, in essence, the idiocy of Pauline Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if their God said. It requires their God to say, "You cannot trust my original plan because it was a cruel hoax. And even though I told you otherwise, and although I proved that this is my plan and that it would prevail forever, in actuality, it was a complete failure. So I asked a cruel and vicious man, a duplicitous man, a sexual pervert, an egomaniac, and a man who was insane and demon-possessed all by his own admission, to come up with an entirely different scheme. Not only did the new one contradict everything I said, unlike the original plan, I provided no evidence or proof of the new plan's viability. So here is the result. Just reject everything I had to say as God and believe this man exclusively, and you'll be saved."
That's just makes you want to throw up.
Yeah, but you tell me what part of that isn't required of the God of Christianity?
Yeah. How do you call the Torah pornographic? I mean,
yeah.
How do you call?
Well, actually, what he called you know, Paul was the first one to come up with the concept of an Old Testament because he wanted a New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was the author of the New Testament. And what he did is he called the old system, the old way, which then became the Old Testament, Paneros in Greek. Paneros is the basis of pornography.
Yeah.
So the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, what he would call the Old Testament, and there is only one Testament for Yahweh, so it's no more old than it is new, because there is only one, and so to differentiate it is a utter waste, misleading. He called it Paneros, pornographic. And this man, you think, was inspired by the same God he demeaned with that term?
Well, then you keep on a little more. You're going to listen to. Now he's the only one that says this. None of the disciples.
Only one. Yes. Only one. He's all by himself. There's nobody else in the world that is
quoting. Yeah, right.
Yeah, you've got Yahweh. You've got the story of Adam and of Noah and of Abraham and of the relationship with Jacob and who becomes Yisrael, and you have the story of Moses, and you have the story of Samuel, and you have then all of the prophets thereafter, including the great prophets like Yashaya, Isaiah, and Yirmiyah, Jeremiah, and you have the great insights provided by Daniel, and Malachi and Zechariah. And then you have Yosha's testimony, and you have his disciples, and they all tell exactly the same story.
Yeah.
They're all reading from exactly the same set of instructions. And then you have this one guy who says, "Oh, by the way, God called me and gave me authority for the entire world, and I'm here to tell you that everything that you heard God say is incapable of saving anyone. Completely wrong. It's mean-spirited. It enslaves. And so, here's my new plan. You ought to believe me."
Just trust.
And now, by the way, in Yahweh, just so that you could trust him, beyond the fact that his writing is stunningly brilliant, beyond the fact there's not a single contradiction in anything he has to say, he punctuates his teaching, his instructions, with thousands upon thousands of precise prophecies, predictions of what will occur in the future, committing them to writing. And he says, "I'm going to provide these so that you have absolute proof that I, as God, authored this. And I'm going to tell you the future of humanity from the moment I created the universe all the way to the moment that I'm going to destroy the universe, so that you'll have absolute confidence that I authored this." Thousands upon thousands of exacting prophecies, all of which have become manifest right before our eyes or have been fulfilled prior to us. And you know how many Paul had?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, he tempted one, and he got it wrong.
Well, yeah, but that's failed.
That's zip. That is still zip, right?
That's still zip. Yeah.
And you're going to believe Paul. I mean, just think about how many unbelievably moronic Christians there are out there. So this man had no prophecy, who contradicted himself all over the place, who admitted that he was a schemer and duplicitous by saying, I'll be whatever I have to be to take advantage, who admitted he was insane, who admitted he was demon-possessed, who admitted he was a sexual pervert, and who claimed that he was inspired by God to contradict God, and you're going to believe him and go to church and call yourself a Christian after this scumbag?
And support it with your money.
Wow.
And your time. Wow. Your efforts.
I mean, you ought to have your head examined if you're a Christian. It's nuts. It's insane. It's demonic.
Well, the tragedy is there's so few when exposed to it, to these type of arguments, and there's a couple more that are tremendous. I mean, you've got written a whole book on questioning Paul, but some of those little choice bits are, you know, like the God calls him the plague of death.
Yeah, not just in
the plague of death.
Yeah, not just in Chabaouk, embrace this Habakkuk, where he goes on and he talks about Paul's personality. He tells us exactly when Paul's going to arrive, and it, by the way, is 666 years after he uttered this particular prophecy to Chabaouk when Paul wrote his first letter. But he told him exactly when he would arrive. He told us about his ego. He told us about his fixation on circumcision. He told us that he would claim title to responsibility for all the Gentiles. And in that, he says that Shaul, naming him by name, this individual, is a plague of death.
Mm-hmm.
But he repeats that some 30 or 40 more times through different prophets. Always Shaul.
Mm-hmm.
The plague of death.
And if you did nothing else but look up his name, you should disturb you. I mean, it says it means question him, question
right,
this.
Right.
It means a place of separation from God. Who the heck calls a representative someone who separates from me?
That's right. Yeah,
I mean,
Sheol and Saul are written the same way.
Yeah.
You know, it's even here in this particular statement that this the messenger who happens to be Yahusha, I ascended from Gigal. A Gigal means to roll away. It means specifically to roll away the burden of sin.
Right.
It is the rock or the stone that is used as a witness to mark the boundaries of an agreement and to define a burial site. So it was the marker of the empty tomb on Mount Moriah. To say this is the marker of the fact that on this agreement I fulfilled it. And it's the basis of Golgotha, which is the place of the skull, which is where the upright pole of Pesach was hung, affirming just right down to the last details the Torah's plan of salvation, and here's Paul saying the Torah can't save. I mean, just the detail of Gigal, of where and how Yahweh went about providing his means to salvation through the Torah is affirmed just in that one word.
Now, the second place, is that not the place where the anointed, or am I confusing it? Is that where the anointed King Shaul is born? Place of weeping and tears.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the in fact, here's some insights on Gigal.
So
no, I think Gigal is the place that that served as the first encampment of the Israelites after crossing the Jordan into the Ardennes into Jericho. The area of Jericho into the Promised Land, and is therefore the doorway from the wilderness into the Promised Land. It was located, it's the location where Shemuel, whose testimony we have been studying, served Yahweh as a judge. And it's therefore where Yahweh's message was shared to his children. However, Gilgal is also the location where Shaul was pronounced king, which thereafter was known for its illicit religious worship.
Okay.
Yeah, it's also the site where Yahweh revealed that he would take up Elijah to heaven. The fact that Yahusha rose up from Gilgal, which is where he rose from the from Sheol, and after exiting the empty tomb, Gilgal, he went to Moichim, which was the place of tears, and the reason, the place of great sorrow, is that this was the journey that the Israelites were going on. It was kind of a way of saying, you know, I've taken you from the hope and the doorway to the promised land, but I'm going to now show you that where you're headed is towards a place of great sorrow and tears. And then, Pauline Christianity is the idea that the Torah enslaves, and by enslaving it would bow you down. And here's Yahweh saying exactly the opposite. I chose to continuously lift you up because you wanted me to take you away.
How do you sell that in light of him coming out of Mitzrayim?
Right. And Mitzrayim, and when you study Mitzrayim, what you find is it's a confining crucible.
Mm-hmm.
And Mitzrayim, by the way, is what Egyptians call themselves today. Because Arabic is derived from Hebrew. So they just use the Mitzra term. Yahweh used Mitzra and then Mitzrayim in the plural. Because of what Mitzra means. And in the plural of Mitzra, it's a confining crucible. And this is therefore crucibles of human oppression, which are associated with Egypt, whose name for itself was the Black Land. The plural of Matzor, which is from Sur, to be confined and besieged by an adversary, to be assaulted and tested to the limit by a foe, to be bound and controlled as a result of being confronted by a militaristic enemy, which hems in, precludes escape, cutting off supplies while relentlessly attacking the source of strength. So in Egypt, who was the foe? What was the adversarial force, or forces, it's plural, that assaulted and tested the children of Israel who were enslaved there?
Well, there were four influences over them.
It was
a political and religious, backed up by military.
Right. And economics, because they were the slaves.
They ran.
They were the economy.
Like Bernie.
They were the labor. Right. Yeah, like Bernie. Yeah, that's like Bernie. So the four adversarial forces that confined them were the Egyptian religion, the Egyptian military, the Egyptian government, and the Egyptian economic interests.
Yeah, you're trapped in the economic.
Right. Capital. So that is what God lifted them up away from. They were bowed down as slaves. And he, before taking them away and withdrawing them, first thing you do is says, you know, you're going to stand up not only before them, they're not going to bow down to them, you're not going to bow down to me. This whole process is about standing. And I brought you to the land. What does the land represent?
It's back to paradise or back to
right. Eden. Back to Eden. Right. Back to Eden. Back to, I brought you to heaven.
Right.
I brought you to live with me.
Yeah, if you're associating with him, that's where home is.
Right. Which relationally and beneficially, I promised, I sevened, I swore, I sevened, because Shabbat means to seven and to promise to your fathers. When did he seven Shabbat promise the land to their fathers? What was the discussion? What was the agreement upon which the promise of the land, of living with Yahweh, was made?
Well, that was with Abraham.
Yeah, and therefore with the covenant.
Yes.
So the promise of the land and of living with God has no meaning whatsoever apart from the covenant. It was only presented in context of the covenant. So therefore, in the covenant, we too have to be stood up, caused to stand, because we want to be there. And the Yahweh's home, his promise of seven, the promised land, is the place that we go if we accept the terms and conditions of the covenant. It's what he offered Abraham as part of the covenant. So, if, as Pauline Christians would have you believe, that the old covenant is no longer valid, then there is no way to live with Yahweh in his land.
Yeah.
It's tied to that. Then he says, and this is the most powerful line, Kirk, I don't think I have, I maybe have ever read in terms of destroying Christianity. And I explained. Now, this is Yosha speaking.
Yes. First person.
First person. Yeah. And I explained I would never break, never split into two, never violate, make ineffectual, nor nullify my covenant with you ever throughout the whole of time.
That's why it grabbed me so much this past week. I just, you know, I said, if you never saw anything else, you can't deal with this. You have to deal with this and the way it is written. And if you, if somebody's out there listening and they've never looked up much, if you look up para, and then you look up...
which, by the way, was negated. It's low parar, P-A-R-A-R. So you can look that up in any Hebrew-English dictionary.
Anything. I mean, I looked them up in tons of them. In fact, I even brought another one this week that I thought was pretty interesting to help me out.
And it means to split, to break, to violate, to make ineffectual or nullify. It was nullified, so it means I will not nullify. I will not make ineffectual. I will never break. I will never split. I will never violate.
Cease, annul, shatter, dissolve, divide, trample, tear it up.
Right. I will never invalidate nor repudiate.
But, I mean, it would be nice if we spoke Hebrew where we just knew all those meanings came
from. Right. I will never annul or abolish. And it was written in the hyphal stem, yuktal, imperfect conjugation. What that means is the subject, the subject, who is Yahweh, enables the object, which is the beneficiaries of the original promise, to participate in this proposed agreement to the extent that it becomes a shared experience, one which is ongoing, continuously unfolding throughout time, never ending, expressed in the volitional form, telling us that this is the way God wants it to be.
Now, hyphal, is it hyphal or the hyphal?
Hyphal, H-I-F-I-L.
Oh, okay, because that's causative active. Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, that what the hyphal stem does, it's a relational stem. All stems are relational. They establish a relationship between the subject and the object based on the action of the verb. And what the hyphal stem conveys is that the subject, this is the subject of this sentence is Yahweh, who's speaking is Yosha. So it's Yahweh causes the object. The object is those who are listening to him, those of us who are reading what he said. So the subject causes the object to engage in the action of the verb.
Yeah, and push up makes us active. Okay.
Right. Which means that we cannot be broken. We can't be split into two. We can't be violated or made ineffectual. We can't be nullified.
Or separated from him.
Right. Or separated from him. So he causes us to participate in the action of the verb such that we become like him. That's what the hyphal. The subject causes the object to participate and the object to be a secondary subject.
Mm-hmm.
So it's explaining that God is empowering us with these benefits. And then the imperfect just simply means this is an ongoing thing with Yahweh. This is something that's going to unfold and be undertaken throughout the whole of time, uninterrupted.